break, it's my pleasure to introduce Hank Jay, and he's from Palmdale. Hank.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Hank Johnson. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. Man, this is a wild group, you know. I'm from Palmdale. It's a little desert town about 60 miles north of Los Angeles, and a big meeting for us there is about 12 people, you know. This is really exciting for me. I drank for 30 years, you know, I hear such exciting things from the podium. Geez, you know, guys get up here and talk about how they used to drink, you know, and get in accidents. This guy got in an accident the first time he ever drank, you know. And I heard about a guy who drove 65 miles an hour in a tunnel and decided to make a U-turn. another guy I heard, he went into a bar and he punched everybody out in the bar, and the cops came and he punched the cops out too, and he got thrown in the jail, and he walked over to the bunk where some guy was laying and pulled him out of the bunk and punched him out. Now that's drinking. I mean, that is really drinking, you know. All I ever did is just sat around and drank. You know, I meant to do a lot of that stuff. I just never got around it. You hear guys introduce themselves, you know, I'm an alcoholic and an addict or an alcoholic and this. You know, I'm an alcoholic and a procrastinator. I postponed 30 years of living. I just sat around and drank my life away. I don't think I was born an alcoholic, because I really did have a lot of fun with it at first, and for quite a long time. I just became allergic to the stuff. You know, I took penicillin one time, and successfully. And the second time I took penicillin, I had a sore throat and went to the doctor, and he gave me a shot of penicillin. And before I got home from the doctor's office, I had to stop the car and take my shoes off and itch underneath my, you know, feet, and I just scratching all over, and I swelled up, and I wound up in the hospital 2 days later. For 8 days, I damn near died of penicillin poisoning. You know, and all of a sudden, I became allergic to penicillin. And the doctor told me, geez, don't ever take penicillin again. You might die. And you know, I've never had a bit of trouble with that. If they had Penicillin Anonymous, I'd have about 35 years right now. But the same thing happened to me with alcohol. I drank successfully for a lot of years, and then the stuff turned on me, you know, and I couldn't handle it anymore. I just used to sit around and in a corner, you know, watch TV, read a book, nothing heavy, like some little condensed version in the Reader's Digest, play phonograph records, and just kind of daydream and fantasize. And my wife, just to cause trouble, every once in a while, she'd come home and find me intoxicated, and she just couldn't stand it anymore, so she'd kick me out of the house. And it never occurred to me to ever argue with her. She'd say, leave, and I just left. I was so unworthy that it never entered my mind to say, wait a minute, I live here too. I got just as much right as you. But no, I just left. And I didn't move very far from home, just down the street. And then I'd work my way back in. And I was in and out, back and forth. She divorced me 3 times. And finally, the third time, I finally got the picture. I says, you want to get rid of me? Fine. Yeah. You can have the house, you can have the furniture, you can have everything. All I want is my stack of old 78 records. They're collector items, and I want those, and you can have everything. And I moved to a little, down at the beach, to Hermosa Beach, a little town there in Southern California, and about a half a block from the water. I thought, gee, this is terrific. I'm gonna be able to go down to the water every morning and run, you know, and really get in shape and all that. as far as I know, the water was down there. I just never got around. And, you know, I went to bars the first time in several years. You know, I'd gone to bars eating, you know, restaurants that had bars. But just to go out to a bar to drink at night, it'd been 15 years or more since I had done that. And I went to these bars, and everything had changed. You know, they were playing different kind of music altogether than I was used to. You know, they're playing all rock and roll and acid rock and all this stuff, you know. And I couldn't find one Tommy Dorsey record on the jukebox. And I was just out of place. And so I finally settled for just drinking and playing old records and fantasizing. And a typical day for me back then was I'd wake up at 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm already an hour late to work. And geez, I'd throw my clothes on real fast and shave and get in that car and weave in and out of traffic and break all the traffic rules. You know, I had to get to work because, I knew I was going to get fired when I got there. And I had this fear of impending doom, you see, because I should have worked yesterday. And I had left all these papers all over my desk, and I had papers in my desk drawer. Some of them were months old. They were too old to turn in. If I turned them in, I'd get fired for holding them so long. And if I didn't turn them in, I was going to get fired. And it was all going to happen today. I knew it. And I'd get to the office, and I'd check my desk out first thing. Everything's the same as yesterday. Whew, man. I'd get a cup of coffee. I'd go back to my desk and shuffle papers and try to look interested. And, and I'd make excuses to my customers. They'd want to know where their stuff was that they ordered. And I'd make excuses like, the class of help we hire now. You mean you didn't get that? Well, you know, they hire these kids right out of high school. You can't depend on them. And I'll personally take care of that today. You can count on that. And or I'd use the computer excuse. That's a good one. They're still using that today. And that's a terrific excuse. You know, the computer's been down for the last 4 days. And as soon as it gets working, I'll get that right out to you, you know. I'm one of the originators of that excuse. I used that excuse before we even had a computer in the office. And at a respectable time, I'd go to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. They sold martinis over there, and I like martinis. And they sold double martinis for $1 during the lunch hour. A regular martini was 75 cents, but for $1, you could get a double. So I say to myself, whoever heard of having one martini? You're going to have two anyhow, so you might as well order the $1 one, and you'll save 50 cents. God knows you need the money bad. And so I'd get to sipping on this $1 martini and kind of check my drink against the guy sitting next to me at the bar. He'd have a 75-cent one, and I'd get to looking at his drink and mine, and I'd say to myself, who the hell do they think they're kidding? This is no double. It's a little larger than the 75-cent one. If it was really a double, they'd be charging more money for it. You know, I've been around. I know these things. They can't kid me. You know, they don't know who they're dealing with around here. So I better have another one. And then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one. And then I'd call the office and tell them, I forgot to tell you I'm going on a lot of calls this afternoon, take messages. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I'd head towards the beach. I'd stop and buy the cheapest bottle of vodka I could find. And I'd get home about 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon. And I'm an extra neat drunk, you know. I hang up my clothes real carefully so that the creases fall properly, and put my shoes away and shirt and everything, put my pajamas on. And this little place that I rented, it was a little private little garage house, a little separate little house, but it was about a 12 by 15 room is actually what it was. And I bought a turntable and 10 speakers from a friend of mine. And I had speakers in all four corners, behind the drapes, behind the couch, in the bathroom, in the kitchen, you name it, I had a speaker there. And And so I'd put my pajamas on, and I'd sit on the edge of the bed, and I'd untap this cheap vodka, and I'd take a big, big jolt out of it, you know, several swallows, and I'd just say, oh, nuts, I ain't done it again today. You know, this cannot continue. You know, you're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why don't you do something about it? All you do is sit around and talk about stuff. You never get around to doing anything. And then I'd put one of these old 78 records on the turntable, something like Billy Eckstine singing, Who Can I Turn To? And I'd get to talking to myself and really give myself a real good dressing down, you know, and I'd say, all you do is waste time, why don't you make something out of your life? At least you can do, you can't do anything about your marriage, but at least you can get a second job and get out of debt. Maybe you can play catch up and get squared away, you know. I could do that. But wait a minute, I'd say, you're in sales. You don't have to get a second job. You know, if you apply yourself in sales, you can make practically any amount of money you want to, within reason, of course. And so, yeah, that's it. Starting tomorrow morning, it's all going to be different. I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. I'm going to get down to that damn office by 7. I'm going to knock out paperwork for a couple hours. And when that phone starts ringing tomorrow, I'm going to be ready to do business. And starting tomorrow, it's all going to be different, and I'm going to devote the rest of this year to work, to earning money and getting straightened around. And I'm not going to drink for the rest of this year. Maybe I'll go to a New Year's Eve party and have a few drinks. But, you know, I can devote 1 year out of my life to getting straightened up, you know? And it just makes good sense to me. I don't know about you guys, but when I make these terrific decisions, have these great ideas, I always have another drink. And then I get to fantasizing, you know, some more. And I think, you know, if you triple your income, you're going to be out of debt in no time. What are you going to do with all the money then? One of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to buy a white Lincoln Continental. I'm going to drive it up to that house where she still lives. And on the way up there, I'll stop at the Hallmark card shop, and I'll buy the most beautiful card they got in the place, you know. No 25-cent or at least a dollar card. And with a lot of beautiful poetry on it. And I'll get a gold-plated key for the car. But on that greeting card, I'll just put, thanks for all the good years, H. You know, not Henry or Hank, it's H. And at midnight, I'll drive that white Lincoln Continental in front of the house where she is. And I'll kind of slip it into the parking place right in front of the house and don't make any noise at all. And I'll tiptoe up on the porch and I'll put that greeting card with the key in it down the mail chute, and then I'll split. And the next morning, she'll get up, and she'll go through her routine, you know, and she'll get her mail. And naturally, she'll open the big envelope first, and she'll open that up. The key will drop out. I wonder what that key is, she'll say. And she'll read this poetry, real sentimental type poetry. Tears will just roll down. It'd just be so excruciatingly painful. It'd be wonderful. Yeah. And she'll say, thanks for all the good years, H. And she'll look out in front of the house and she'll see that Continental out there, brand new. And the gold-plated key and that card. And she'll put it all together that that's her automobile. Then she won't think I'm so bad. Then she'll be sorry, by God, that she got it. And I don't know about you guys, but I get a big thrill out of giving those big gifts like that, so I have another drink. I look up at the clock, it's almost 11. My God, I can't believe that this day is gone. It's 10 minutes to 11. Jeez, that can't be right. Yeah, and I check the time, yeah, that's right. And then I realize I'm almost out of booze, so I throw my clothes on over my pajamas and run 2 blocks to the liquor store. And that's when I first started jogging about that time. But I had to get there before the place closed, yeah. And I'd get there, a bottle of Smirnoff's. I always bought the better brands there in the, right around where I lived, you know. I wouldn't want them to think I was cheap there right in the neighborhood. And then I could stroll back to my shack with peace and comfort and contentment for the rest of the night. And I'd have dinner. Cold hot dog out of the icebox. And then I'd have a few more drinks and play a few more records and start rehearsing the speech I was going to have to give because I was going to be salesman of the year. I knew that. And the next morning I'd wake up, it'd be 10 o'clock. And I'm already an hour late to work. And see, I'd throw my clothes on real fast and shave and weave in and out of traffic and get to the office and check my desk out. You know, I knew I was going to be fired because, you see, I should have worked yesterday. And I'd check my desk out and everything's the same as yesterday. Man, I'd get a cup of coffee and go back to my desk and I'd shuffle papers and make excuses to my customers and think of any excuse I could think of, you know. And then at a respectable time, I'd go next door to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. And I'd go over there and make my big decision of the day over there, whether to have the dollar one or the 75 cent. And then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one, and then I'd have another one. I'd call the office and tell them, I forgot to tell you, I'm going a lot of calls, take messages. And I'd head towards the beach and stop and buy a cheap bottle of vodka and get home about 2 and hang up my clothes and sit on the edge of the bed in my pajamas and untap this vodka. And I'd say to myself, well, done it again today. You know, this cannot continue. You're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been... You know, in debt, why don't you do something? All you do is sit around and talk about it and everything, you know. And you get a second job at least. And I don't need to get a second job. I'm in sales, you know. And all I gotta do is apply myself. Starting tomorrow, it's all gonna be different. I'm gonna get up at 6 o'clock. I'll get down to that office by 7. I'll knock out paperwork. And starting tomorrow, it's all gonna be different. And for the rest of this year, just work, work, work. And I, you know, I'll work sell Monday through Friday. Hell, I, you know, I can go in there on Saturdays and do all my paperwork and catch it all up, you know. And I got a key to the place. I can even go in there on Sunday and I'll plan my work for the coming week. And, you know, if you're in sales, if you plan your work and then work your plan, you can't miss. And I was just so happy about that that I'd have another drink. And I didn't do that once or twice. I did that hundreds of times. Towards the end of the month, the boss would want to know, are you in sales here? And I'd say, yeah. And he'd say, well, how about making a sale? And I'd say, don't worry about a thing. I'm a fast finisher. And I was, because I was scared. I was afraid he'd fire me, so I'd work around the clock. And, you know, I always made my quota. This company I work for, they set a quota. If you make the quota, at the end of the year, they give you a big plaque with your name on it for outstanding salesmanship and product knowledge and all this good stuff, all over this plaque. For 8 drunken years in a row, I won a plaque every year. And then I got sober. And for the next 8 years, I didn't win a plaque. And I lost my motivation. See, I used to operate on fear. And when I finally got to AA and got sober, I realized that I didn't have to be afraid anymore. And so, in fact, I got kind of spiritual. You know, and you don't have to work, you know. And once you sober up and find the program of AA, God's going to take care of you for the rest of your life, right? And some of us just kind of, I know I was one, I'm just a little cut above the rest of the crowd, and I didn't have to engage in the everyday things that other people do. And as a result, after 2 years of sobriety, I walked in the office and the guy fired me. And he says, you're fired. I says, fired? Don't be ridiculous. I've been with this company a long time. I got an outstanding sales record. He says, not lately, you don't. And I said, well, I'm not going to let you fire me. I'm going to go, before I allow you to do that, I'm going to go see the regional manager. and I went to see the regional manager at his plush office in Century City. And I used to say that I took my fifth step with that regional manager, but what I actually did is I sniveled and cried to him. The guy had been with this company a long time now, and the guy went to fire me. Can you believe that? I got an outstanding record with this company, and the guy, what he don't know is that 2 years ago I completely changed my life. I stopped drinking. I'm trying to make it with my wife again and the kids and try to pay my bills on time and be a citizen in the community again. And now this joker wants to fire me. And this regional manager said, gee, that's really very interesting. I never even knew you had a problem with booze. Yeah. But I sure hope you and your wife, make it okay. And he says, but I can't interfere with them down there at that office. He says, but I tell you one thing I can do for you. He says, I can put you on paid leave of absence for a short period of time. You claim to be a salesman. Go sell yourself to another branch office. We got 80 of them. And so that's what I did. And I'm still with this company, same company, after all these years. And sometimes I get a little worried because the last 4 or 5 years I've been winning plaques again. Not on purpose, though. I'm not in competition anymore. I'm not trying to be the number one salesman in the company. But things are a lot easier now. I don't have the pressure on me that I used to have, But before that all happened, I got a call one night, and my ex-wife called me and said, come and get your drunken son, just like you are. And it seems that he was like 16 or 17, and he'd gone to high school, and he was getting in a lot of, trouble, nothing major, just a lot of nickel and dime stuff, but just enough to drive my ex-wife crazy. Trying to cope with a teenage kid. And he went to a party one night and got drunk and came home and threw up on the carpet or something. That was the last straw. So she called me and said, come and get your drunken son. He's just like you are. And so I did, naturally. Whatever she said, I did. It never occurred to me to argue with her. I didn't want him to come and live with me, but he didn't want to come and live with me. But she said. So he used to come down and visit me occasionally before that. I never knew what to say to him. What do you say to a 16-year-old boy? I couldn't ever think of anything, And I'd say, well, geez, if you were, a good father, what would you be saying? So then I would go into this, gosh, I'm really worried about you in school. Your grades aren't what they should be. You should be getting all A's with your intelligence. My God, you should be on the honor society. And with your looks and personality, you ought to be student body president. And I don't know why you're not playing football. You just really worry me. And he'd just kind of shrug that off. But if I was drinking, that's if I was sober. But when I was drinking, I just tended to slobber all over him. I'd tell him how much I loved him. All the trouble your mother and I have had over the years, has nothing to do with you. We love you. He'd just sit there and cringe. Once I started on that, I couldn't stop. And I'd kind of corner him, He couldn't escape from me. I just keep telling him how much I loved him and cry and all. And he finally would escape, And the next morning, I'd wake up and I'd just be ashamed of myself. Not that I had been drunk the night before. I was ashamed that I had told my son I loved him. And I couldn't even look him in the eye. I'd take him home and drop him off. Because I'm from the old school where you don't show any kind of emotion. You never tell anybody how you feel about anything, and it's not cool to do that. And I used to go to these jazz joints and hear these great musicians blow trumpets and saxophone, just go crazy, these jazz musicians. And it's not... You're not cool if you even tap your toes. You sit there with a cigarette in one hand and a drink in another, and you never move a muscle. Then you're cool. And I practiced that all my life. And so I was ashamed of myself when I let my guard down. But anyway, he went home one time after spending a weekend with me, and he asked his mother, he says, "You've divorced him. Is there any kind of legal action I can take?" I don't want to go back. And so he had to come and live with me. And that was a start of a beautiful relationship, however, that we've still got going to this day. And it wasn't very long after that that my ex-wife moved in with us, too. And we converted that garage house, the garage part of the garage house, into a bedroom, threw some tar paper down on the old carpet and a bed out there in the garage. And she said, "I won't fight you on your drinking anymore. In fact, I'll join you." And I should have been suspicious right then and there, because all the years I was married to her, she never drank. She can't drink. Some people are allergic to alcohol. She is. From drink one, she was allergic. You know, we'd go to a party and she'd take a drink and gag. You know, I'd try to get a big tall glass, put a lot of 7-Up here. Have a few of these. You know, we're here at a party. We're supposed to be having fun. You know? And she would always end up throwing up or something. She could never drink. You know. But during that 2 or 3 year period we were apart, she taught herself how to drink. You know, you can do that. You know, if you apply yourself and practice each day, why, sooner or later you get, you know, so you can drink pretty well. And practice makes perfect. And by the time she moved in with me, she was damn near perfect. I'll tell you that. She could drink any kind of drink there was and not even make a face. When I'm not drinking, I'm not all that. I'm kind of a grouchy guy. I just seem to sit in the corner and read a book or something, watch TV. Just leave me alone. Don't ask my friend advice. Don't ask me for any money. You're free to do anything you want to. You know, I'll just leave me alone. But if you give me one drink, all that changes. And I don't care who you are. You're the most interesting person I have ever met in my entire life. And I want to hear your life story from day one. I'm prepared to sit up all night with you and hear your plans for the future. As long as we've got booze, I'm with you all the way. Now my wife, on the other hand, is a very friendly, outgoing person. She knows everybody. You know, she knows all the people in the neighborhood. She goes to the supermarket. The girls there at the checkout stand, they all know her. She knows them. She knows their names, their husband's name, and all their children's names. And I don't know how she finds out all that information so fast. You know, I could go to the same market, and they'd never know me. I could go for 20 years. They'd never recognize me. I'd have to show an ID to cash a check. You know? But she's just extra friendly. But you give her one drink, and all that changes. And all the pent-up emotions and hostilities of a lifetime come out in that first drink. And she blacks out, and then she gets hostile. And she does bad things. And she's not a fun girl to be with. When she drinks, she's no fun at all. And we could never drink together successfully. It was always an argument, and it was just bad news. And she would break my old 78 records, you know, just because I'd played them more than once. And I was playing the same songs for 30 years, and I'd play one of those old records, and it was like the first time I ever heard it. God, that's good. Play it one more time. You know? And I'd play it again, and again, and again, and again, and I just get hung up on a song. And sometimes I get hung up on one trumpet tune, and I'd lay that needle in there, and clear that trumpet one more time. And she used to just drive her crazy. So she'd get up and take the record and smash it. And I'd say, "My God." And I said, "That's a collector's item. You can't replace those." "Good. I'll never have to hear that one again." She did stuff like throw the Christmas tree lights and all out the back door. And just all, you know, she was just crazy when she drank. And she'd never remember a thing the next morning, she said. I'd say, you know, you don't remember what you called me last night? You know, like, I don't know where you ever heard that language. You sure never got it from me, that's for damn sure. Yeah. And she never knew what she had done, she said. You know. And I never knew anything about a blackout until I came to AA, because I just remembered what I did. You know, I don't know what's worse. You know, not remembering or remembering. I just happen to remember, that's all. And anyway, I finally told her, you know, this thing is not working out again. And, you know, I allowed you to kick me out of all those other houses through the years. But I moved here first. You know, we're not married anymore. You divorced me, remember? So this time you go. I'm going to go to my brother's house tonight. When I come back tomorrow morning, I expect you gone. And that's all the time you gave me in the old days. So this time you can just pack up and leave. When I come home tomorrow morning, I expect you to be gone. So I went to my brother's house and drank with him all night. And so while I was gone in a blackout, she decided to commit suicide again. She was always committing suicide. That's another thing about her. She was suicidal. You know, she used to commit suicide on a regular basis. And in fact, even after she got sober on the program of AA, you know, after she had a year or so, she was going to, things were so bad, really serious stuff, you know, and she was going to commit suicide again. And then she remembered she was the cookie lady at the meeting, so she had to postpone it. And finally, her sponsor told her, you know, you better knock that crap off. One of these days, you're going to hurt yourself bad. So she kind of knocked that off. But this night, she decided to commit suicide again. But before she did, she went into the closet where my clothes were hanging and took a knife and just slashed every stitch of clothes I owned. Just, you know, cut my ties in half and ripped my shirts and my coats and everything. And even took the knife and stabbed my damn shoes. And completely made a shambles out of the whole thing. Then she took the rags that she... And, you know, before that, we had started back to group therapy again. We had gone, you know, therapy off and on for a lot of years. And this last deal was a couple's workshop. You know, that's where married couples go and cop out on one another. And there's a therapist there. And the therapist finally asked me one time, "Do you really drink as much as she says?" And I said, "Hell yes. I drink a lot. Who wouldn't? You know, married to a woman like that. I got two of the worst kids you could possibly imagine. This pressure job I'm on, my God, you know. So I drink a little. What's the big deal? You know, no one's hurting from my drinking but myself. You know, the kids have got shoes. They've never missed a meal. You know, I don't know why they make such a big deal out of me drinking." And he said, "Have you ever thought of joining AA? And I said, "You know, AA." I said, "No, thanks. I've already been to AA." And I had gone to a meeting one time. And it was one of these meetings where the leader passed out chips. I guess you do that up here, you know. But he said, "Anyone just finished their first 30 days of sobriety? If so, come up and get your chip." And like a poker chip, and it says one day at a time, 30 days or something. And this guy came up, you know. "My name's Joe Blow, and I'm an alcoholic, and I know this is a spiritual program, and I found God when I walked through the doors of AA, and it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings. And just before I came to the meeting tonight, I got a call from my boss, and he's made me general manager down at the plant. The one most wonderful 30 days I've ever spent in my life. God bless every single one of them." And he sat down. I thought, "Oh, God." Anyone else just finished their first 30 days? And here comes Mary Smith. "My name is Mary Smith, and I'm an alcoholic, and I found out this is a spiritual program, and I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And you know, it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings. And And, you know, hate is no longer a word in my vocabulary. I love everybody, you know. And just a few, you know, when I see my children now, they look at me with respect in their eyes. And my husband is looking at me with renewed interest. What a glorious program this is. And for you newcomers, keep coming back and work these 12 steps. And God bless you all. I sat down. Oh, God. I never went back. That's it. And so when this therapist said, hey, I said, forget it. I've already been, you know, in some kind of a spiritual program. I think it's a religious cult of some kind. I says, it's okay for them, but not for me. But I said, I heard about some stuff called anabuse. I read an article in the magazine about it, and I think I'll get some of that. I'm going to quit just to show her once and for all that alcohol has nothing to do with our problem. You know, my drinking has nothing to do with it. And so he put me in touch with a doctor, and I made an appointment with this doctor, and the receptionist said, well, if you want anabuse, don't drink for at least 48 hours prior to coming on the appointment. And, you know, I didn't drink for 48 hours. And I went on this appointment to the doctor, and the doctor checked my heart and blood pressure, and he called me into his office, and then he closed the door. Oh, God, you know, it must be serious, you know. And he sat down at the office there at his desk and started talking to me about the disease of alcoholism. You know, he started telling me about how people with the disease of alcoholism have character defects. And they have trouble coping. Instead of coping, they drink tonight instead. And tomorrow morning when they wake up, why, they still got all their problems, only now they got a hangover on top of it. And then they continue to do this over and over and over again. I never identified with a word he said. He pulled a book out from his shelf and started reading how people try to control and enjoy their drinking by switching from scotch to brandy and stuff like that. I know now he was reading a portion of chapter 3 to me. And I finally, he says, you know, I could give you anabuse, but if what you say is true, that you haven't had a drink for 48 hours prior to coming here, you know, you need never take another drink as long as you live. And I wanted to quit, you know, but I wasn't quite prepared to quit that long at that time. And he says, you know, you don't need anabuse. You don't need it. And he says, my suggestion to you would be to drive up to the Manhattan Beach Clubhouse and buy the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, if you promise me that you'll do that. He says, I'm going to tell you something that I wouldn't tell most of my patients, but due to the nature of your appointment here, he says, I assume you have trouble with alcohol. You wouldn't be here asking for anabuse. And he says, I'm going to tell you something. He says, I happen to know a little bit about this. He says, you see, my wife's an alcoholic. And we've tried everything. We've tried rest homes and sanitariums and anabuse and psychiatrists and you name it, we've tried it. Nothing's ever worked for her, but she's sober now. She goes to AA, and that's what I recommend that you do. So please drive up to the Manhattan Beach Clubhouse and buy the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and there'll be no charge for this call. And that's the only thing that guy said that day that impressed me at all. But I did. I went up and bought that book, and I threw it on my dresser and had another drink and thought, what a crazy doctor. You know? And that right after that is when this fiasco happened with my wife cutting up my clothes. And she had been with me and heard all what the doctor had said. So she went back and asked him if he thought she was an alcoholic. And he said he didn't know, but he gave her the 20 questions, and she passed an appropriate number correctly. And so he said, well, you either need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon, and why don't you go to some meetings with my wife? She'd be happy to take you. So she came home that afternoon, and she said, I'm going to go to AA with the doctor's wife. And I said, oh, God, what now? There's always something with you. You know, I admit you shouldn't drink. That's right. That's established. You know, you can't drink. I know that. But, my God, you don't need to go to AA. And not that bad. And so I says, besides, you know, what makes you think that the doctor's wife is going to drive down from Palos Verdes in her Cadillac and pick you up in this dump we live in? And she said, well, I spoke with her this afternoon. She said she'd be by about 7:45. She's not coming in. She's just going to toot the horn, and I'm supposed to go out, you know. And I says, well, if she comes, just remember what the name of that organization is. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. That means no names. Don't give them my name, whatever you do. I don't want anybody knocking on my door trying to convert me. And this car drove up and tooted the horn, and off she went to a meeting. And the very first thing they told her in AA, the very first thing they told her was that it wasn't her fault that I drank. You know, they could have started her off with any number of other things, but I started right off with that, you know. And I said, you know, we don't have that kind of power over people that we can make anybody drink, so don't carry that guilt around with you. You know, you didn't make him drink. He would have drank whether he would have ever met you or not. And so don't carry that guilt. And she said, and they also told her, you can't make him quit either. You don't have that kind of power over anybody that you can make anybody quit drinking. So don't even try. Don't pour his booze down the sink. He'll just go buy another bottle. But if you think you've got trouble with alcohol, maybe you better come back to these meetings and work on your problem and just let that SOB drink himself to death. If that's what he wants to do, it's his life. And she kind of liked the ring of that. And so she went to meetings with the doctor's wife. And every once in a while I'd go to a meeting with her just to be a good guy. And I hated the meetings. You know, seemed like those same two people were at every meeting I went. My name's Joe, and I'm an alcoholic, and I found God when I walked through the doors of AA, and it's the lights in the eyes of the people that turn me on, keep me coming back. And I just got word today that they've made me a full partner down at the plant. I'm taking delivery on my Mercedes in the morning. What a wonderful, glorious life this is. Mary Smith, the same thing. And my name is Mary Smith. I walk hand in hand with God through the doors of AA. And I just love every single person in the, not just in AA, but in the whole world. Just a few short months ago, my children were failing in school, and now we're getting letters from all the major universities throughout the United States offering free scholarships. And I'm also pleased to stand up here tonight and announce that my husband and I are a couple once again. And I just could not stand it. And then we all stood up and held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. How hokey can you get? And then you think you can go home then? Hell no. There's another meeting that starts immediately after the meeting. And that's where these ladies would start coming at me. I could see them from my... And they had their claws bared, you know. And their fangs showing, you know. And like little miniature Draculas looking for new blood. And they'd ask me questions like, are you Lou's husband? And I'd say, yeah, I'm Lou's husband. Well, are you an alcoholic too? No, I'm not an alcoholic too. I'm a visitor here. She's one. Work on her. Yeah. I finally told my wife, I said, that's it. I've gone to my last meeting. I can't stand this harassment. Everybody wants to know, you know, how long, when you took your last drink and all that stuff. And I said, I'm not going to go to AA anymore. But I said, you know, I do know I'm an alcoholic. I realize that I am. And so I'm going to quit drinking. And you know, I did. I quit drinking. And a little bit before Thanksgiving. And I stayed sober clear through Christmas, the holiday season. stayed sober. I even remembered to buy Christmas presents and everything that year. And I'm sure I must not have been the most pleasant person to be around, but by God, I was sober. And I was really sober. And the Saturday night after Christmas, my wife went to a meeting, and I stayed home, and I took a little mini inventory of myself, you know, and I said to myself, you know, you've proved, you know, if you can not drink from since before Thanksgiving clear through Christmas, that proves you're not really an alcoholic after all. So I went to the liquor store and I bought a half pint of vodka, and I no sooner got it back to the house and I drank it, and what the hell have I half pint for? I went and got a fifth, went and got another fifth, and I drank all Saturday night and all day Sunday, and closed the bar up at 2 a.m. and, you know, and I woke up the next morning, it was 10 o'clock, and God, I was already an hour late to work. I knew by the time I got there I was going to be fired. Okay. I knew I was going to be fired, and, you know, and I got to the office and checked everything out. Everything's the same, and safe again one more day. And I went over to the bar a little early that day because I was sick. You know, I hadn't drank for a little over a month, and I had poured all that alcohol into my system, and God, I was sick. So I went to the bar a little early that day and had a Bloody Mary. You know, that's not really even a social drink, for God's sake. That's medicine, you know. Not a glass of medicine. And the guy made the drink, and I drank it straight down. I spilled it all over my tile, nuts. And I said, make me another one. And I went to the restroom and cleaned the tomato juice off my tie. And I went back to, and he said, the bartender said, did you want another Bloody Mary or did you want a martini? And I said, oh, just skip it. And I went over to the coffee shop section of this bar, and I had a sandwich and a glass of milk, and I haven't had a drink since. But you know, I've often thought since then, you know, I didn't realize that that was going to be my last drink. I had no idea that was going to be my last drink. Had I known that was going to be my last drink, I sure as hell wouldn't have had a Bloody Mary. I'd have had something like in a fancy glass, you know, at least a dollar martini, something decent, and I would have drank it straight down, and I would have thrown that glass, you know, and stomped out of the bar, triumphant over alcohol. But yeah, I didn't know it. I wasn't aware of it. I found myself at a meeting on New Year's Eve, of all places to be, you know, and a couple of weeks went by, and then it finally dawned on me that I hadn't had a drink in a couple of weeks. And then anger set in. I had just completed 30 years of drinking. And I got this rotten wife. I got two of the worst children you could possibly imagine. I got the pressure job. And I owe everybody money, and it's all past due, months past due. And when the phone rings, I jump clear across the room. I know it's a bill collector. Someone knocks on the door. I know it's the police. I don't know what I've done, but I know I'm guilty. And now I can't even drink. Now they've taken that away from me, too. What am I going to do with the rest of my life? Nothing. That's what I'm going to do. There's nothing to do if you don't drink. Everything I've ever learned in my entire life, except working, I learned drinking. You know, I either drank before, during, or after, and generally all three. And everything, every social situation I was ever in my entire life, I drank. And or I wouldn't go. And so now, what am I going to do? There's nothing to do. My life is over. You can't ever go to a decent restaurant ever again. What's the first thing they ask you when you go to a nice restaurant? The first thing they want to know, would you like a cocktail before dinner? And you can't say to them, well, yeah, I'd like one, but but you see, I've got this disease, and it's of a twofold nature. It's an allergy of the body is coupled with an obsession of the mind, and if I even take one drink, I can't predict my behavior. If it wasn't for that, I'd sure have one. I used to think you had to explain all that stuff to people. I used to spend a good portion of my day, every day, explaining things to people that didn't want to hear the explanation. Someone, if I was standing on a street corner and somebody walked up, I'd start explaining what I was doing. That's one of the things that I've got quite a bit of freedom now that I've been sober for a while. I don't have to explain near as much as I used to. Every once in a while, I catch myself explaining something to somebody, and I can stop myself right in mid-explanation. And you know what? The people I'm explaining to, they never know the difference. Yeah. No one's listening to any of that crap. You know, no one's listening to your explanation, at least not mine anyhow. And so, but back then, I just had to explain my life away. I was so unworthy that I just had that need to explain to people everything, my circumstances, you know. But you know, almost everything, in fact, every single thing that I knew for sure has turned out to be all wrong. For instance, I went to a nice restaurant just recently. The waitress came up and said, "Would you like a cocktail before dinner?" And I said, "No, thanks." And you know what? It didn't even faze her. All she did is went to the next table and asked them, and they did. They're always drinking over the next table. I'm the only guy in the whole place not drinking. You know, that's all right. I've had my share. That's one of the cruelest things that I've learned in my entire life. They don't care if you drink or not out there. That was one of my biggest concerns about joining AA. What are they going to say when they find out I don't drink? Well, I'm here to tell you, they don't give a damn whether you drink or not out there. They care here, they make a big deal out of it around here, you know, that you don't drink. But out there, they could care less. In fact, I've had relatives and good friends tell me, "Geez, you know, you haven't drank in all that long, why don't you have one? If you've been without one for that long, I know you're not really an alcoholic." You know, they don't care out there. But you know, the thing that worries me is every once in a while I'll go to a nice restaurant and I'll look over at that next table and they're drinking martinis over there. And sometimes it looks attractive to me. Sometimes it looks good. And I think, geez, you know, wait a minute, you know, think this through, you know. If you take that drink, you know, you're going to end up. I don't order that drink. But it just proves to me that I'm not well yet. And you're looking at a sick man here, you know. I'm not well because every once in a while it looks attractive to me. So what I've decided to do is I'm going to leave my body to science. I'm going to leave my brain to science anyway. When I die, why, they can check my brain out and they can see what a real alcoholic's brain looks like. And I'm sure when they take my brain and put it down in that solution, that alcoholic solution, it's just going to kind of quiver. And then it's going to say, "Ah." Until that time, I'm going to go to a lot of meetings. I'm going to call my sponsor regularly. I'm going to read the big book. And I'm going to come to San Jose if they ask me on a Friday night. I'm going to do everything I can to maintain my sobriety. Because I'll tell you, left to my own devices, I'll drink again. If I don't go to meetings and stay active, I'm going to drink again. And I know a lot of guys that are sober a lot longer than me that have done it. It's just that we shouldn't take ourselves so serious. You know, if you're taking yourself serious, You're missing the biggest joke of all. All this, you know, we should take the program serious, but, you know, when I think back of all the tragedy, I just loved it. I just walked through one tragedy after another, I thought. And now that's the way it is. You know, I can't claim to be a victim anymore. Geez, that's a hell of a note after you're sober for a while and you realize that you did it all to yourself. And so I'm not a victim. I know no one's out to get me. That's another bad discovery, you know. And you run out of excuses. And what sooner or later, if you stay sober long enough, and you're lucky enough to stay sober, you'll start working the steps. And that's what I've done. But after 2 years of sobriety, I started to tell you that I got fired. You know, what happened to me is I just got so spiritual that I kind of sailed off into the sky. And my sponsor pointed out to me that some of us just get so heavenly that we just become of no earthly good to anybody. And that's what happened to me. And he pointed out that in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it states in there that it's okay to have your head in the clouds, but you should keep your feet firmly planted on the ground and take these steps. And that's what I've been trying to do ever since. And it's about time to knock off. And I want to tell you folks that it's been a pleasure to be here. You know, I'm not cured by any imagination. And I'm still living with a lot of unsolved problems. And I've got a lot of anger in me. But, you know, I never think of drinking about them, you know. I'm able to cope with my problems today without drinking. And, you know, that's a funny thing. I'm sober longer than my wife is. How could that possibly be? She went to AA before me. Well, she didn't hear the part about the pills. You know, where I come from, you're not sober if you're taking those pills or smoking those funny cigarettes. And so she thought they were talking about the kind of pills that you smuggle in from Mexico in your hubcaps or something. You know, not prescription drugs, you know. And her sponsor said, yeah, you've abused those too, you know, get rid of them. So I took my last drink on December the 29th, 1969. And my wife flushed her pills down the toilet on January the 1st, 1970. And if you'll notice, there's a whole year difference. I've got time on her. That's the reason I'm making this talk here tonight instead of her. My son, you know, he used to look at me funny all the time. And part of the reason I finally found out, the reason he was looking at me so funny, is that he was stoned out of his gourd. Seeing he had a problem with alcohol, too, and drugs, and LSD, and you name it, he's tried it, you know. And I'll be damned if he didn't turn himself into AA when he was 21 years old, and he's got 11 and a half years of sobriety. My wife and I are sober 15 years. You know, between the three of us, we got 41 and a half years of sobriety. And that's not too shabby. And our daughter sends you greetings from Al-Anon. And we're an AA family, and we weren't any kind of a family 15 years ago. And we're still not the best family on the block. I'm not trying to lay that one on you. But we've all got programs, and we've got a chance. And before I sign off, I want to tell you that a couple of things, you know. And one of them is that when I see my children now, they look at me with respect in their eyes. And I'm proud to stand up here tonight and make an announcement that my wife and I are a couple of things. You know, I'm kind of a slow learner, but I know now that that this is a spiritual program. And that I found God when I walked through the door. And you know, it's the lights in the eyes of the people that keep me coming back. Thank you very much. All right. Can we also have a round of applause for Dennis, our 10-minute speaker?